Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Welcome to the channel, and thanks very much for joining me here right now. So I just finished talking with Robert S. Boynton about his new book, The Invitation Only Zone, The True Story of North Korea's Abduction Project, and this came out in 2016. Now, this is a book that's a real pleasure to read. It's super gripping, while also being a really fascinating introduction to a crucial period, actually a series of nested crucial periods, not just in the history of North Korea and the history of Japan's relationship with the Koreas, but also in world history, more broadly speaking. So you'll hear us talking about this in a moment, but basically what the book does is it takes us through a kind of long history from the late 19th century through the 21st century of engagements between positive, negative, neither, both, between Japan and Korea in its various forms around the notions of identity and race and ethnicity and selfhood and citizenship. And you'll see history, intertwined histories of Japan's colonial project, the relationship between Japan and Korea on various different levels and in various different ways, with the stories of the abductions or the repatriations or the defections or any number of other ways of getting from not North Korea to North Korea on the part of a number of really fascinating people. You're going to hear about, along the way, Japan's Indiana Jones. You're going to hear about a super badass sushi chef. You're going to hear about a number of fascinating figures, and we get into some of their stories very briefly, but if you get your hands on a copy of the book, and I really recommend that you do so if you like a really well-written story on top of just a really fascinating story, you'll read much more about them and others. So I will leave it there and leave you to it. I really appreciated Robert making the time. Again, it's a fascinating book. It's a great read, and this is a book that I would strongly consider assigning in all kinds of different classes. And I may actually think about this if I'm teaching modern East Asia or transnational history in the future. I can imagine undergrads really just kind of super getting into this, in part because it's just, like I said, a really interesting read. Okay, so I'll stop there and I'll leave you to it. As ever, thank you so much for your support of the channel, for listening, and for being here with me today. I hope you enjoy, and I will leave it at that. I'm here today to talk with Robert Boynton about his new book, The Invitation Only Zone. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Robert, and thanks not just for writing a really timely and really fascinating and really engagingly written study, but also for taking time away from your work to talk with me about it today. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start at the beginning. But let's start at the beginning by starting at the end. Now, the full title of the book is The Invitation Only Zone, The True Story of North Korea's Abduction Project. And in the epilogue of the book, you talk a little bit about the genesis of the project, sort of what brought you to this particular project in this particular way. You mention seeing a photograph in the New York Times in October of 2002. Now, this photograph was of two middle-aged Japanese couples and a single woman descending from a plane at Tokyo's Haneda Airport. The headline was this: Tears and Hugs as Five Abducted Japanese Go Home to Visit. So, Robert, as a way of opening up how you came to this project and sort of what the genesis of this was, can you talk a little bit for us about this photograph and this moment and what brought you to the work that we're talking about today?
Sure. Well, I was reading the newspaper, as I do every morning, on the morning of October 16th, 2002, and I opened the New York Times to page A3 and saw this article that you just quoted from the headline about five Japanese who had been in North Korea for 24 years, who are now returning to Japan for a visit, quote unquote. And this whole thing just sort of knocked my socks off. The questions immediately arose. What had they been doing in North Korea? Were they the only ones? Why were they being let out now? Why were they only visiting Japan, not returning there if they had indeed been taken by force. So, you know, all these questions were running through my mind, and I, you know, greedily picked up the next day's paper and the next day's, and there was not a word in the Western and the American media about the fate of these five Japanese. This was just over a year after 9/11. And that so thoroughly dominated the coverage of anything outside the United States that, you know, news from East Asia practically didn't exist. So I was very frustrated as I tried to learn more. And I, you know, read pieces here and there. The Guardian had some good pieces. There were Japan Times, some other places had some good pieces. But I it was very frustrating, and I was very, very curious.
So the research that undergirds the book is really extensive. You spent 3 weeks to 3 months in Japan and in South Korea every single year from 2008 to 2015. Now, again, at the end of the book, you talk about having written about race and ethnicity in the American context and the kinds of projects that were bringing you to Japan and to South Korea initially in the first place. But this is a lot of work that you really kind of metamorphosed, it seems, into what we have today. So can you talk a little bit about that part of it, sort of how in the course of your movement from an initial engagement with Japan and South Korea all the way through this extensive fieldwork there, did the project in this form develop from its initial kind of inklings to what we have here?
Well, as I said, I first learned of the story in 2002, and I followed it for the next several years on and off. You know, journalists often collect string on stories they're interested in and then in hoping to use it later on. So I did that. Fellowship to go to Japan in 2000 from the Japan Society. And as part of the fellowship, I had to propose several stories to report and look into during the months I was in Japan. And one of them was the abductions, which, as I said, had been sort of stewing in my mind for a long time. One of the other stories was I wanted to look at Japan's largest ethnic minority, which is the Korean ethnic minority known as Zainichi in Japan. And the reason was that, you know, Japan is suffering from a very low birth rate and has a very restrictive immigration policy. Clearly, something, unless Japan is willing to depopulate itself as thoroughly as it seems to be, something has to give. And I was, you know, curious, what would multiculturalism look like in the Japanese context? And my test case was looking at Zainichi and how the 600,000 to 800,000 Zainichi long-term residents of Japan had fared there as sort of a test case for that. And I, in this, simultaneously, I was also doing reporting on the abductions, and I was lucky enough to meet some of the abductees and start talking to experts. And the strangest thing happened, which is that the two stories, the story of the abductions and the story of the Zainichi and how they were faring, started intersecting with each other. And I would have people, you know, I'd be doing an interview about the abductions, and they would start talking about the Zainichi minority and possible role they had played or hadn't played in the abductions. And I'd be doing an interview about the Zainichi situation, and the abductions would come up in those things. So I saw that there was a connection that was sort of being played out in front of me between the two. And the connection that I was interested in, particularly with the ethnic story, the Zainichi story, really was based on and came out of my interest in race and ethnicity in the American context. In the 90s and aughts, I wrote a lot of pieces for The New Yorker, for The Atlantic Monthly, and elsewhere about Black intellectuals and the sort of discourse about race and ethnicity that was playing itself out in the United States, and looked at people like Ralph Ellison, Albert Murray, other writers who had, I think, very interesting provocative ways to describe the African-American experience and the role that it had played in the forming of American identity, which I thought was very suggestive and very helpful. And I began to see ways in which this debate resonated in Japan, the way that for all of the discrimination that Zainichi suffered in Japan, Zainichi played an incredibly vital role in the entertainment industry, in sports, in all sorts of aspects of Japanese life. There had also been this very pronounced Korean wave going on in the 90s and in the 2000s, where Korean culture was very much in vogue in Japan. There were all these stories about housewives learning Korean in order to watch their favorite soap operas. And I really began to sort of see how the role that Zainichi played in this larger Japanese society was in some ways parallel to the role that African-Americans had played in American society. And that's part of what really got me going about this subject, realizing that I could write a book that was an exploration, the first English language exploration of the abductions, but also would have been grounded in something a little deeper, grounded in something that I felt like other people who were writing much more from a Japan studies or Korean studies perspective weren't really looking for.
Now, you describe the book as an act of extreme journalism. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I compare what I was doing to what, say, rock climbers will do sometimes. Rock climbers will sometimes leave behind their ropes and climb a rock face without them as a sort of act of extreme rock climbing. And I felt that in this case, I tend to like to prepare a lot for my journalism. I do it. All my interviews are done face to face. I do them all myself. I don't really relegate any of the tasks to anyone else. And here, to do this story, I was caught in a position where I had to rely on translators, interpreters, where I couldn't simply go off and ask the questions I wanted to ask on my own, where the amount of research I could do was somewhat limited in terms of the languages that the primary documents were written in. So, I felt that it was a kind of journalism that was, strictly speaking, out of my grasp, but it was at a point in my career where that's precisely what I was looking for. I had recently received tenure at NYU and was very grateful for that and really felt a intellectual responsibility to do something that was going to be extremely difficult, perhaps impossible, something that as an ordinary freelancer or as an assistant professor concerned about tenure, I couldn't do, and now I could. So this form of what I called extreme journalism was really kind of an act of faith to say, well, what are the limits to someone's ambition, and can the form of journalism that I teach and practice, could it reveal something about this part of the world and this extraordinary episode?
Awesome. And cheers to both tenure and to the kind of sense of intellectual and social responsibility that comes with tenure. I'm cheersing you with my mug of tea, even though you can't see it. So cheers. We'll take a sip of this to mark that. Okay, well, thank you so much, Robert. And let's kind of dive in now to the story. So as the book tells us in the prologue, in the words of the book, people began disappearing from Japan's coastal towns and cities in the fall of 1977. Now, they were also disappearing in this period from other parts of Asia, from Eastern Europe, and from the Middle East. Now, one particular abduction sets the stage from the very beginning, and we really follow it as a thread, as a narrative thread throughout this story up to the very end. This is the abduction on July 13th, 1978, of Kaoru Heisuke and his girlfriend Yukiko. Now, they take on, as I said, a really prominent role in the story, and we follow them throughout. So let's actually kind of open the story for listeners the way the book opens and talk about this abduction. What do we need to understand about this particular moment on the beach in 1978 and what happens after with Kaoru and Yukiko in order to understand what happens next?
Well, Kaoru Heisuke and Yukiko Okodo, who was his girlfriend at the time, were simply at home in Kashiwazaki, which is about 50 miles west of Niigata, home on vacation. Kaoru was a student at Chuo University, law student at Chuo University. Yukiko worked at a beauty cosmetics firm, Kanebo, and they were, you know, simply taking a bike ride at night. It was, you know, hot. They went down this long hill and went to look at a fireworks display that was being going on in the water. They walked over to a secluded section of the beach, and quickly one man came up to them and asked for a light, at which point Kara reached into his pockets, pulled out a lighter, and three other men rushed them. They jumped them, they bound their hands and legs, they gagged them, they put them into sacks, zipped them up, and then put them onto a small dinghy, which then took them out to a larger boat waiting for them about 45 minutes out, and then that larger boat took them back to North Korea, to Chongjin. The next morning, they arrived there. So this was sort of the quintessential, sort of typical abduction that took place several times to several different couples that I'm aware of, and probably more than I'm not aware of. And, you know, I use this as one because it was so typical. It was so random. The sea level at that particular day was the only day when a boat could get as close to shore as it did. The fact that it was a new moon meant it was dark enough so that one could sneak up on someone else. There was a kind of cosmic bad luck that fell upon Hasuike and his girlfriend. And it really sort of just, it for me, it captured the randomness and the extreme oddness, and also the terror of that kind of a moment, the kind of moment that, you know, I think everyone, no one fears actively, but, you know, there's nothing comforting, there's nothing familiar at all about the whole situation.
And it's so kind of poignant, right? They were going to get engaged, and it's this, like, beautiful moment, and so they do wind up getting married 3 days after they're reunited in North Korea in 1980, but lots happens in the meantime, and what happens next, we will come back to in a moment. But ... that's not the only thread of the story that we follow. Woven through the stories of the abductions and the particular individuals that experience these abductions, either as friends and family members or as abductees themselves, or otherwise, we also have an ongoing thread of the kinds of historical, cultural, and social circumstances that ultimately gave rise to the conditions in South Korea and North Korea and Japan from which these abductions emerged. And this is where we go in Chapter 2. So in Chapter 2, you take us into what you call the Meiji moment. Japan becomes modern. This is the title of the chapter. And we meet a figure who is familiar to people in Japanese studies, but perhaps not in this context. This is Edward Morse, who comes to Japan in the late 19th century, who authors a work called The Shell Mounds of Omori, and whose story is bound up with larger issues of debates around Japan's origins, race in Japan, and with a particular figure who you call in here the Japanese Indiana Jones. And you know, if you use that phrase, I have to ask you about it, right? So let's talk about what's happening in this early part of the story. Debates about Japan's origins and about race, Edward Morse, and Ryozu Tori, the Japanese Indiana Jones. Go for it. What do we need to know?
Well, you know, the Meiji Restoration was an incredible moment in Japan, the likes of which I don't think you see in most cultures, where it was a culture that, for very specific reasons, decided to not just open itself up to outside influence, to Western influence, which is the way I had always understood it until I really started looking at it, but embraced the new, embraced the modern in a way that was kind of dizzying. Anything that was new, anything that smacked of a break with the old was considered. One person considered, the Minister of Education considered changing from Japanese to English as the standard language. The entire education system was redone, which had been a fairly Confucian system before then, a Sinocentric one before that. So as part of this incredible attempt to really redo society from the bottom up, there was a concerted recruitment effort made. Professors from the United States, from Germany, from the UK, to staff and build up these universities. And one of them was Edward Morse, who had been a well-known, well-thought-of shell expert in working at Harvard at the time, and had become a real devotee of Darwin and Darwin's thought and the evolutionary sort of revolution that was going on at the time, which coincided very closely with the whole Meiji Restoration. The Japanese were very interested in evolution. They could clearly tell that Darwin was, again, the new theory, that it had extraordinary explanatory power, and that it was scientific and also had social dimension to it. And it was desperate for people who could explain it and lecture on it clearly to the public. Morse was interested in going to Japan for the shells, and ended up giving these standing room only lectures on Darwin to not just students, but to people, villagers, people in Tokyo who were just interested in the general public. And these things would go on for hours, and they'd be, you know, people would be sitting on the floor or standing. I mean, it was not comfortable, and they were just wrapped. So he became a very important figure for the way that Darwin's ideas of evolution and, sadly, the sort of pseudoscience of a race, the Western pseudoscience of race, became was introduced to Japanese thought. And it was, the Japanese did what any society does when it takes on, appropriates knowledge. It also made it its own. It refashioned it. It reworked it. And the pseudoscience of race became a very important part in the birth of the discipline of anthropology in Japan, which very quickly became defined, or at least oriented itself around, the question of who were the Japanese in this new scientific world. If you left behind the various creation myths that the Japanese had used to narrate their national identity, and you now took on this new scientific regimen, who were the Japanese? What had come before that? I mean, the whole idea of prehistory and the idea that when the history of a people could be uncovered through archaeology and through that kind of evidence. Those were ideas that were animated by the ideas of evolution. So the Japanese very quickly started studying this, and a number of the people who studied it were students of Morse. A man named Tsuboi Shogoro was one of them. And the other one was, as the person you mentioned, Torii Ryozo. That's right. So Torii Ryozo was this incredible figure, this young man who was quit school because he was bored, I think in fifth grade, was, you know, largely an autodidact, his parents were quite wealthy. They bought him one of the very first English-Japanese dictionaries. He read like a maniac. He studied the archaeological remains around his hometown, the island of Shikoku, and he went to the Tokyo University to study with Tsuboi, and became this kind of rollicking archaeologist, going out into the field constantly. And one of the reasons he went out into the field was that Tsuboi started the first journal of anthropology in Japan. And one of the things that he insisted on was he wanted to have the anthropologist and the archaeologist who wrote for his journal. He did not want sort of armchair intellectuals. He wanted people who actually went out into the field and gathered new evidence. You know, he had in mind a very principled notion of what the scientist does. And Torii was perfectly happy to go do that. So he was writing dispatches back from, you know, Manchuria, from Korea, from all over the place. They were being translated. His work was being translated to French and elsewhere. And he just, you know, became this crusading guy who actually also made a lot of money through his popular journalism. I think from sort of like a Stephen Jay Gould or something like that, someone who was able to write for the popular audience as well as for the specialists. And he, you know, was able to travel. This was coincided with the early years of Japanese colonialism. So he was able to travel oftentimes with or just after the army had pacified or annexed an area. So in Manchukuo or in other parts of China and Korea, he would often arrive just after or with the military. And and his studies of these groups and were you know, very good anthropology, although he was a little bit in love with doing things like, you know, measuring head size, which was sort of the rage at the time. But he did very, very good, precise work. But much of that work, in addition, was used by the Japanese colonial authorities both to understand and pacify the local people. And so, you know, though I think his work was intellectually honest and ingenuous, there were some very disingenuous uses to which it was put.
Right. And so one of the really interesting things that happens as we move through the chapters is the story really unfolds according to a thread that explores the consequences of what you've just said, including Japanese Indiana Jones, for the rest of the story. And as we move through the book, you bring us into the context of Japan's takeover of Korea as what the book calls an act of slow motion colonization. You mention here in chapter four that by the end of World War II, 4 million Koreans were living outside of their homeland. And we need to understand this, and we need to understand the broader context of the kind of guerrilla campaigns that emerge alongside this by Kim Il-sung and the way he fashions himself in a role akin to the Japanese emperor. There's lots of historical context that we're going to be getting that's going to inform how we understand these abductions. So we'll get back to that in a moment, but let's ping-pong back, dot, 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 another ellipsis, to Kaoru and his girlfriend Yukiko. All right, so they're reunited in North Korea. They're married, and they live in what's called an invitation-only zone. You take us into kind of the texture of their lives there, which is really, really fascinating, and I want to just mark the fact of that for listeners. It's absolutely fascinating to read about that. You tell us about Kaoru making golf balls using glued-together cotton swabs. There's just all kinds of things about their quotidian life that's really fascinating. Okay, but there's a looming question here that might be in the minds of listeners and that I think we have to attend to sort of understand how to move forward from these cotton swabs, glued together golf balls. How did they get there? And that is this. Who are these people who are abducting people like Kaoru and Yukiko? And why bother, right? So who's doing this? And why would they bother abducting people from the beaches and cities like this? Like, what were they hoping to achieve?
That is the $64,000 question, of course, about the abductions. Why go through all this anyway? And the answer that is probably most accurate is also the one that is hardest to get one's mind around, especially in 2016, where North Korea is, an economically challenged, to say the least, country, is that there was a belief that it would help North Korea reunify the peninsula and spread Kim Il-sung thought and Juche philosophy throughout Asia, including Japan, and literally through the world. That this was really a point in which North Korea had a sense of really manifest destiny, that it had outproduced the South from the end of the Korean War in 1953 into the 60s, perhaps even into the 70s, and really felt that it was on the right side of history. The abductees were recruited, first of all, with the hopes that they could spy on behalf of North Koreans, these Japanese, who had been, you know, snatched off of beaches. So you can see the level of self-confidence that is operating here. And if for whatever reason they didn't spy for them, that they would then train North Korean spies to pass as Japanese. One of the things the North Koreans did was a number of the abductees were people with very little personal history, who had never had a driver's license, never had a passport. They would take their identities, forge passports, forge driver's license, and then let their spies operate throughout Japan and around the world under those identities. I mean, a Japanese passport at this time was pretty much an open entree to anywhere in the world, and that was something very valuable to the North Koreans. So the origins of the project may seem slightly absurd to us, but what one has to remember is that the North Koreans had actual empirical evidence that this kind of thing works, because they had been abducting, in the very first phase of the abduction project, had been abducting South Korean fishermen in the 50s and 60s. And but when they abducted them, they would take them to the mainland, and they would essentially parade them around, bring them from banquet to banquet. They would be greeted in every town by women with flowers saying, "Oh, please stay, please stay." These were largely illiterate, very poor fishermen who were being told that, you know, here in the North, you are the hero. You are the center of the North Korean experiment. You're treated terribly in the South, and here you will be treated very well. A number of these fishermen ended up staying in North Korea. Some of them were held back by force, but most of them left and went back with a very favorable attitude towards the North. So, you know, the kind of transformative experience of seeing the North Korean experiment and being won over by it was something that the North Koreans had seen with their own eyes. It was perhaps, you know, after the past due date by 1977, but of course you don't know that at the time. You still have the hubris, you still have the optimism of a decade before, and this was largely the atmosphere in which the abductions took place.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure, but I would imagine when you give interviews about this book, everyone asks you to talk about Kim Jong-il's abduction of the South Korean Orson Welles, the film director, mm-hmm. and his ex-wife, Elizabeth Taylor of South Korea. So this is going to be the interview where I don't ask you to talk about that. Instead, what I'd like you to talk about is a figure that you raise in the context of the discussion in Chapter 6, as we sort of move through this story, of how to understand this abduction as a kind of statecraft. And you introduce us to this super badass sushi chef. This is how I think about him, Kenji Fujimoto. Now, Kenji Fujimoto takes us into his experience working with and working for Kim, in which, and I'm going to quote this because there's no way I can rephrase this in a way that's going to remotely touch this quote, in which at banquets, Kim, quote, insisted the sashimi be so fresh that the mouth of the fish was still moving. When drunk, he would command his guests to strip and dance nude. Okay, so let's talk about this sushi chef. Who is he? Can you talk about your experience here, and what significance does he have, and does this relationship with Kim have to the story?
Well, Kenji Fujimoto, which is a pseudonym, was a Japanese sushi chef who answered essentially a wanted posting for a job in the early 1970s for a restaurant which he then found was in Pyongyang. It was a restaurant that the wages were far greater than discovered why when he got to Pyongyang. The goal of hiring him to do that was really to train a sort of a whole cadre of sushi chefs and other so that North Korea could engage in this modernizing process. He came to the attention of Kim Jong-il one night when Kim Jong-il and his sort of his party came to the restaurant and ate there. And the two men became very close friends. He hired, or I don't know if you're running North Korea, you don't hire someone, you just tell them to come work for you. And Fujimoto became the sort of head chef, really, for Kim Jong-il, and would preside over these incredible parties. And he also would go on these incredible shopping sprees on behalf of Kim. You know, Kim was this guy who knew the best place to get everything, though he had almost never left the country. Kim Jong-il went to China several times. He's born in Russia, contrary to the myth about his being born in North Korea, and perhaps went and spent a good part of his childhood there. But he'd really seen very little of the world. Yet he knew, you know, the best fish was in Tokyo. The best lamb was in New Zealand or Denmark. The best clothing was in England. The best wine was in France. And a lot of this, I felt that Fujimoto was a good way to help explain the way that Kim Jong-il related to the rest of the world as essentially this consumer. And the fact that he used a Japanese chef who was not abducted, who was hired, was, I thought, sort of the icing on the cake, in that it to me, it represented another dimension, a much less tragic dimension, whereby Japanese culture and Japanese figures were the way that Kim Jong-il was able to experience, look at, and really connect to the outside world. So the two of them became sort of bros together, and they would water ski together and do all these sorts of things. In fact, Fujimoto, when I interviewed him, I've interviewed him a few times. I interviewed him, I think, in 2008. Was the first person I ever heard mention Kim Jong-un. He said Kim Jong-un is going to be the next leader of North Korea. This is long before Kim Jong-il died in 2012. So he actually has a lot of insider knowledge. He's become this sort of talking head about North Korea and about the Kims in particular. And, you know, I've talked to people in the intelligence service, both in Japan and at the CIA, who have vetted him and found that his information was extremely reliable. So he's sort of this strange figure who is kind of the connection between North Korea and the outside world, or Kim Jong-un and the outside world. He also had a very dramatic reunion just 2 years ago when he went to Pyongyang, and there's this famous picture that was on every newspaper in Asia of, you know, Kim Jong-un hugging Fujimoto. Mm-hmm. So he was this, and he, you know, comes off as this kind of gangster. He wears, you know, shades. He's got his headband on. He's sort of in disguise, but it's this crazy look that basically screaming, "Hey, I'm in disguise." It's nothing. There's nothing low key about it. It's everything he does is very calculated. You know, he's the tough guy. In fact, during one of the interviews I was conducting with him, some guy who was clearly either connected to the Yakuza or was trying to make me think he was connected to the Yakuza came over and, you know, introduced himself and, you know, offered to introduce me to politicians and all these sorts of things. And then he ended up paying our bill, actually, by the end. So it was a very surreal trip into a different part of the world, interviewing Fujimoto.
So you mentioned a little bit before that the book is not just about abductees, and it's not just abductees who are going back to North Korea, but it's also people who went there voluntarily or sort of voluntarily. And the rest of the book, as we move through the chapters, chapter 9 and thereafter, you take us into different contexts in which this is happening. And I just want to kind of mention this as we kind of open this up. So in the mid-1950s, Kim Il-sung invited Japan's Koreans to move to North Korea. And you take us into a kind of the project to repatriate Koreans from Japan in 1959. Now, early in the 1960s, this becomes really interesting. The repatriated Koreans, or some of them, begin to send secret messages back home, telling the rest of their families not to come because the conditions were so bad. And there are these images of notes on the backs of stamps. There are notes that you describe written in code. Okay, so this takes us into, okay, so some of these Koreans in 1959 departed from Niigata, and you take us into your own experience later in the book in chapter 11, traveling to Niigata, and you describe this as a city psychologically divided into abduction land and repatriationville, to investigate the disappearance of a young girl who was abducted while walking home from badminton practice in 1977. This is Megumi Yokota. Okay, so can you open up the story of Megumi Yokota for us? What do we need to know to understand what you think is the kind of core significance of this particular case to the larger story that the book is telling?
Megumi Yokota was this 13-year-old girl who was abducted from her hometown of Niigata, say every feet from her front door one evening after badminton practice on her way home with some friends. She has become something akin to the patron saint of the abduction activist movement in Japan. This, you know, cute, sweet, innocent little girl whose life is forever altered and obviously destroyed through this chance encounter with these North Korean spies. It's not clear exactly why she was abducted. They weren't typically going after children. The thought is that they misunderstood or misperceived her, thought she was an adult or something like that, or were abducting someone else and she saw and then had to be taken as a witness. No one really knows. But she became a very important figure. But for many of the people who became activists and really energized by this issue in the 80s and 90s and 2000, many of them were really driven by their empathy for Megumi Yokota, and her parents became a very important driving force in the eventual association of families and others who were trying to bring this issue to light in Japan. So she, it's unclear exactly what happened to her. The North Koreans claim that she committed suicide in her, I think, her 30s, and there was a big controversy about whether her remains were actually the remains the North Koreans gave the Japanese were actually her remains or not. Sort of difficult to settle. What isn't difficult to settle is that she married a South Korean abductee, a man named Kim Yong-nam, who had been abducted from South Korea when he was about 17 or 18. And they married and had a daughter who is the spitting image of Megumi. And the daughter herself has had a daughter since then. And Mr. and Mrs. Yokota, Megumi's parents, have finally now met with their granddaughter in Mongolia 2 years ago. So, you know, to me, she was really the heart of the movement in the sense that she was the animating figure for so many people. And also she represented, and her fate represented this sort of strange combination of forces. I mean, here she is in North Korea marrying a South Korean abductee, the two of them having to essentially become North Korean, having a daughter who is fully North Korean. It showed some of the tangled ethnic, racial, national lines that the kind of blurred together in this sort of upside-down world of the abduction project.
Great. Now, as you kind of move us forward, those lines get tangled even more in really interesting ways. Now, I won't ask you to talk too much about him because we have lots more of the story to get to in the remainder of our hour, but you also bring us into the story of another fascinating figure. This is Sergeant Charles Robert Jenkins. He is really the fixture of Chapter 12, and we see him afterwards too. Now, he was patrolling in the DMZ, and he actually defected to North Korea in the mid-1960s. And you can see him on YouTube. I checked this out to make sure that I could tell listeners. You can see him on YouTube. He actually becomes featured in a film, or in film and on TV. On TV, he is featured in a 20-episode miniseries, as you tell us about in the book, as Dr. Kelton, head of U.S. Korean War Operations, in a show called Unsung Heroes. So listeners can actually see him acting. It's amazing to watch this. He thought North Korea was trying to breed a group of abductee children super spies. And so it's actually really interesting to go into kind of the worlds of some of the people who, you know, in this case, left voluntarily and what they thought was going on with these abductions. And we're going to see him later on as well. Okay, so as we move forward and we meet some of these figures, we also meet figures associated with another offshoot of the story, part of the story that is particularly interesting. This is the Red Army faction. Okay, so you bring us into the context of the Red Army faction, introduce us to the leader, Takamado Tamiya, and don't just introduce us to the Red Army faction, but also importantly to the Red Army faction wives. We have a quote here from Tamiya. "We all must find women. It is our revolutionary mission to do so." Okay, Robert, who are the Red Army faction wives? What do they have to do with the story? And how do we get to this quote from where we were and based on where we're going?
Well, the Red Army faction was a Japanese New Left revolutionary group that believed in, had a theory of what they called simultaneous worldwide revolution. They came very much out of the 68 riots and protests in Japan that started off as a protest against the American-Japanese security treaty. They were a very, very far left group. And I use them because their story, first, it pertains, as I'm going to describe, to the abduction project. But secondly, also, again, you see this mixing of peoples, this back and forth that supposedly never took place during the Cold War, in fact, taking place all the time, whether it was repatriation or abduction or, in this case, hijacking. So they hijack an airplane in 1970. Their original goal was not to go to North Korea, but to go to Cuba, where they wanted to get military training so they could return to Japan and begin this worldwide revolution. They knew that North Korea had good relations with Cuba, and they thought if they could just get the plane to North Korea, then the North Koreans would give them safe passage onto Cuba. Well, Kim Il-sung had other ideas. He saw these largely Tokyo University elite students as a real opportunity for the North. And so he made them stay. He made them permanent guests, really. And indeed, four of them are still there in North Korea. He put them through all sorts of education, in Juche philosophy, in Korean language. They kept on asking for military training, and he was reluctant to do that, to give them that. He did give them eventually some sort of low-level military training. They lived in another community called the Revolutionary Village just outside of Pyongyang. And as things went on, what Kim Il-sung realized and what they realized was that their small numbers was not going to make the kind of vanguard first wave of revolutionaries that they needed. So they came up with an idea of recruiting, the word they used, one could say abducting or tricking, Japanese tourists and other students to go to North Korea to marry them. Now, at this time, there was a very healthy admiration for North Korea. Every prefecture in Japan had a Juche study group in 1970. So there was a very large supply of young people, men and women, who were interested in going to North Korea. And so through various techniques, they got a number of women and some men to join them in Pyongyang. They all married and started having children. And this was, part of this procreation project to create this sort of revolutionary class. Some of the people that they recruited to the North did not go willingly. I've interviewed several people who went willingly and then had trouble leaving, and vice versa. But they created this kind of this sort of small army that was supposed to play a major role in spreading Kim Il-sung's thought throughout the rest of Asia. And Kim called them my golden eggs. These were the things that were going to play that role and help him spread the word. So they played both an important role in terms of the Japanese role in North Korea, and also it complicates the matter because they were directly and indirectly responsible for a number of the abductions. One of the most famous being Keiko Eremoto, a girl from Osaka who disappeared from London and was never seen again.
Right. Now, Kim Il-sung eventually dies in this story, and there's widespread starvation across North Korea. Among the people who are suffering are the children of Kaoru, who we now come back to. And we're going to come back to Kaoru and his family for the rest of the book. Now, in order to understand how we get back to him and how he gets back to Japan and how his children get back to him, we need to look at a moment of negotiations between Japan and North Korea. And you take us into this toward the end of the book. Now, Kim meets with Koizumi in Pyongyang. And they meet in this conversation that gets very, very complicated. Okay. And so what I want to know for you, I'm just going to hit this back to you. What for you, and there's a lot we could talk about here in terms of this conversation and its significance. There's a lot that listeners will find in the book, especially in chapter 17 and 18. But for you, what's most kind of interesting and important about the way that conversation played out for us to understand kind of what's going to happen when we come back to Kaoru and his family and his children and the conclusion of this story as we get to the end?
Well, the North Korea was in dire straits after the death of Kim Il-sung in 1994. There were a series of crop failures. There was terrible flooding. There have been some very unwise decisions made by Kim about foresting and tiered farming and things like that. It led to a lot of flooding and a lot of destruction, and ultimately to famine. And Kim Jong-il realized that he needed to have an ally of some sort, a rich ally, preferably. This was also the period in 2002 when George W. Bush declared North Korea as part of the Axis of Evil, Iran and Iraq being the other two parts of the Axis of Evil. We know what happened, at least to Iraq. And so the North was very nervous, and they had played for years this brilliant form of strategy of cozying up to either the Russians or the Chinese or the Japanese or Americans and playing them off against each other. And this was another chapter in that relationship. So they began negotiations, secret negotiations with the Japanese that went on for quite some time. And the negotiations were aimed at normalization of relations and ties and the presumed large amount of money that would come with such normalization. South Korea had gained something like $10 billion in aid from Japan in 1965 when it normalized relations, and the North was marking that up with an inflation and wanted that much or more. The sticking point for the Japanese came again and again was the reputed or the alleged abduction of Japanese that had been going around. There had been rumors for a while. As it happened, there was no definite proof until in 1987. There was some indirect proof, but the Japanese knew they had to resolve this before there could be any kind of going ahead. And this was a very difficult point for the North Koreans, because every time any Japanese had brought up or had the temerity to bring up the abductions in the previous years, the North would respond in high dudgeon. They would either literally get up and leave meetings which was mentioned, and denials were uniform. So this would require them to do a complete volt face and admit to something that they had denied. And what's more, the Japanese wanted them to free whatever abductees were still alive. Mm-hmm. So this was not a small thing to do, and it was yet part and parcel of these negotiations. And it was a little unclear. So in 2002, in September 15th, Junichiro Koizumi, Prime Minister of Japan, and his retinue show up in Pyongyang for these negotiations. They're going to sign this thing called the Pyongyang Declaration, which is a whole series of agreements leading towards normalization. And it's clear that Kim Jong-il hasn't really been told that he has to apologize for the abductees. And just before the two of them meet, Kim and Koizumi, one of Koizumi's advisors is given a report that says that the abductees, the North Koreans admitted to taking 13, that 8 of them had died, mm-hmm. and that 5 were alive. And this was very different from what they expected. I think they'd expected them all to be alive and released or something like that. And so Koizumi gets this news immediately before he's supposed to meet with Kim, and is just shaking with rage practically. And very quickly, maybe half an hour into their conversation, he says, "Look, I've gotten some very bad news about these abductees. This is really unacceptable. What's going on?" And you can tell, or the negotiators I interviewed there could tell, that Kim is taken aback. I mean, no one speaks to Kim Jong-il this way, not even the prime minister of Japan. And they take a recess. And finally, Kim comes back and makes something of an apology and an admission of guilt to Koizumi. This was never written down, but it was an oral apology. And that makes it possible, they think, for the two countries to continue on their merry way towards normalization. This, of course, explodes in their face. Because once the Japanese public finds out about the confirmed information they've had about the abductions, which had been denied by the North Koreans, had been not affirmed by most of the Japanese media, and also not confirmed by the Japanese government. So here, for the very first time, the Japanese public learns that not only had the abductions indeed been going on, as something I compare to, you know, learning that alien abductions had been taking place in, you know, despite all the denials. So not only had there been abductions by the Japanese, but it turns out that the government, some people in the government, knew about them at the time they were taking place, and certainly in the aftermath of them. So this highly paternalistic state, which sort of, you know, claimed to take care of the Japanese, had in fact not been taking care of the Japanese. So Japanese public went nuts. And for a time, the activists who surrounded the abduction movement, some of the people who led to the disseminating of this information, were really calling the shots in Japanese foreign policy. The Japanese foreign minister, which is, you know, all powerful, found that he had to run things by these activist groups, and the Japanese public just wouldn't hear of it. The idea that you would continue to negotiate and normalize relations with a state which had done this to your citizens and lied about it, and now, you know, half of them are dead, was just, you know, outrageous to the Japanese public. And it was impossible. And to this day, it's never been resolved. And no one's ever figured out a way back to get the freedom of any other abductees that may still be languishing in North Korea.
Now, by the end of this story, we follow Kaoru Hasuike to his home. His children are ultimately sent to Japan to rejoin him and his wife. And you end the story with a conversation with him. So can you, as a way of also bringing us to our conclusion as we look ahead to the end of our hour together, can you talk about what for you were some of the most important or transformative moments of talking with him after all of this? And you talk here about the importance of understanding his work in translation and as a translator, kind of understanding how he comes to terms, you know, to the extent that he has with all of this by the end of the story.
Well, Kaoru Hasuike is a very admirable man, very intelligent, and he was the first of the abductees I talked to, and the one I talked to the most over the years. He had returned, as you say, to Japan in 2002, ended up staying, finally got his children back 18 months later, which must have been a harrowing 18 months, not knowing whether your children would be released by North Korea, and had largely supported himself in this time as a translator of Korean to Japanese literature. He was very skeptical about the press, didn't like the way the Japanese press had dealt with him and the abductees, also felt feared that they were putting the abductees who remained in North Korea in jeopardy, and so was very reluctant to talk. I sent him a letter asking for an interview, and I got back a response that said, I'll talk to you on three conditions. First, we can't talk about the abductions. Second, I need to be paid. Third, I need to know exactly what you're going to write and where you're going to publish this. Well, as I told him, I said, well, fine. If we don't talk about deduction, that's fine. I'd love to talk to you about interpretation. As for payment, I can't pay you. American journalism really forbids that sort of thing. I wish I could, but I just can't. And third, I can't tell you what I'm going to do with this. I'm at the very beginning of this project. I'm still educating myself. So, you know, I'd be lying if I did anything. And he said, okay, fine, come. And so I went up to Niigata with my interpreter, and we spent a full day or close to a full day with him. And the conversation started off and was largely restricted to a discussion, a really philosophical discussion about translation. And I've always been fascinated by translation, both, you know, metaphorically and actually. How do you translate between traditions? How do you translate between groups, much less between languages? And, you know, he was very eloquent about this because what I liked about the topic was it was really a great stroke of luck because it enabled him to speak about the abductions and to speak about his relationship with Korean culture, Korean culture and the relation between Japan and Korea, in a metaphorical way without sort of, I mean, we did end up talking about the abductions, but, you know, without explicitly doing so. So, you know, he, and it really became clear to me that he developed a great fondness for Korean culture. He had developed a great love of Korean people. He met many ordinary Koreans in North Korea over the years who he found were very good people. So his hatred was towards the regime that had captured and imprisoned him, not towards the Korean people. And it extended to the Korean language. He loved the Korean language. He was very interested in the Korean history. And he described these ways that he felt that Korean culture and Japanese culture sort of augmented each other, that they supported each other, that the reticence of the aesthetics of Japan, say, where the drama of a moment is often heightened by understatement, was in some ways corrected by the sort of boisterousness of Korean culture, the kind of overstatement, the what I always think of as almost the Americanness of Korean culture, the kind of outlandishness sometimes. And he spoke of this balance, and he spoke of each of these cultures quite lovingly. So it was an opportunity, I think, to provide a safe area for him to talk about these abductions and even to talk about what he, it's hard to choose the right word, not appreciated, but what he came away with that he could actually use in his life in Japan.
Wonderful. And thank you so much for talking about that. I think I also wanted to kind of mark the importance of translation there. And I'm really grateful that you talked about that for us, because this is something that may not be obvious to listeners and potential readers from the book, that it does actually have a really thoughtful discussion of translation and how that fits in to all of this. This is in chapter 22. So listeners who are particularly interested in that can find that discussion there. So, Robert, we're now at the end or toward the conclusion of our conversation. And there's, of course, a whole bunch of things that we haven't had a chance to talk about. You just mentioned in the context of Kaoru Hasuike's conversation, the importance of a theme that runs through the book. And I just wanted to mention that and then ask you if you wanted to mention anything else. And that's the theme of the intimate connection between Japanese and Korean culture, right? And this is something that comes up really throughout the book, throughout the historical chapters and moments, and also throughout your narrative. Given that, is there anything else, or really anything at all, that we haven't had a chance to talk about or to talk much about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners and perhaps leave listeners with as they look forward to becoming readers?
Well, yes, there's one thing, and it really takes off from what you just mentioned, this intimate connection between Japanese and Korean culture. I think anyone who's honest with himself, who's spent considerable time in Japan and the Koreas, knows right away that there is this intimate connection. It's not just historical, it's also contemporary. It's found in culture, it's found in sports, it's found in all sorts of other things. I mean, there's linguistic connections that are, you know, we could go spend all day talking about. And I felt like that was sort of the moment, the point of tension in this story. You know, there's a sort of a narrative that says, that's very popular in Japan, that says, who are these crazy people, the North Koreans, and what did they do to us, the abductions, and why would they do such a thing? And there's a kind of superficial answer, which is, well, you know, they hate you because of a colonial period. But in fact, we know all sorts of erstwhile colonial powers and people who were living under them who have come to terms with each other. Even the Taiwanese and the Japanese have very good relationships. So I wanted to dig much deeper into that. And I felt like the if not the answer, then at least the beginning of an answer of why it is that there's so much animosity and so much similarity between Japanese and Korean culture came in an exploration of the sort of what Freud called the narcissism of small differences, the determination or the determinedness of both the Japanese and the Koreans to create a break with the other culture. In the Japanese, one of the, you know, the breaks is with its sort of national identity. We are, you know, the post Second World War national identity of Japan became, we are a pacifist nation of farmers and fishermen who have never really been interested in the outside world, which is belied by its entire history, certainly the history before 1945. And the North, and also in the South, this idea of the pure Korean ethnic heritage. We are the most homogeneous country on earth. And, you know, there's this sort of essential mystical Koreanness, which has been the same way for millennia. And, you know, the two rhetorics are really very, very dependent on each other and intertwined with each other. And that was something I really wanted to tease out, not necessarily as a way to solve the abductions, but I felt like there was a kind of intellectual history that was lurking in the background of the abductions that I wanted to get at through an exploration of these questions.
Well, thank you so much for spending the time to do that, Robert. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me, for writing the book, and best of luck with whatever comes next. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed the conversation.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us here at the podcast, and we will catch you later.